thought isn't original with me, but it's not with Disney either. However, it is Easter, so I want to apologize to the wonderful world of Disney freaks that might be in the room. Really, I'm not that sorry. I've got another Disney zinger for you. Did you know that Beauty and the Beast, as enduring as that story clearly is not, contrary to the theme song, a tale as old as time? It's not. Although what it is, I mean, it is old. It's not as true as it can be either, Ariana. No, by its own admission, Beast is a fairy tale. Gripping, yeah. Magical, clearly. Inspiring on several levels. But the big award for both the oldest and the truest story ever told goes to, envelope please, the story of the Bible. And yeah, I said story, not stories. Did you catch that? In fact, the amazing story of God stretches across about 1,200 pages through 66 chapters, was written by 40 different authors in three different languages who lived on three separate continents over the span of 1,500 years. Yet one story. One story with one central character and one consistent theme. I mention that because a common complaint about the Bible is it's just too convoluted with all those diverse and kind of odd and downright unbelievable stories featuring the snarly, angry God in the Old Testament and a new and improved and a way nicer God in the New Testament. And while it does seem, I grant you, that there are truckloads of stories in the Bible, every one of those stories is actually networked back in to a far greater story. In fact, the greatest story ever told, with every chapter and subplot contributing to this climactic conclusion that is the Bible's ultimate story. Others will say that the Bible is just a rule book telling us in no uncertain terms what we should do and, way more irritating, what we shouldn't do. And though it is true, there are rules in the Bible that give powerful insight into how life works best, rules aren't the point of the Bible. No, the big point in the story of God, it's not about anything that you or I ought to be doing. It's about what God has already done. Now, others will say that the Bible's just a bunch of random hero stories with oversized portraits of larger-than-life people that we normal folk could never hope to be like. But here's the truth about that. Most Bible characters, even the headliners, weren't in truth really all that heroic. Even his finest struggled. They'd get scared and run away, or prideful and chart their own way. Just saying, the Bible is not convoluted. It's not a book of either rules or heroes. What it is a story. Not a fairy tale, but the truest of all things true, come alive in real life. It's the adventure story of just one hero who traveled from a place far, far away just to rescue the people that he loves. And folks, it takes the whole Bible to tell that story. A story that began all the way back before there was a beginning, when there was nothing. No light, no life, nothing. No hopes, no dreams, just nothing. Now, follow me, because if once upon a time there was nothing, but nothing ever happened, there'd be no story to tell. Because all there would be was nothing but God, right? But this God that was back in the beginning, this God was and still is love, which created a significant problem, because a God of love needs somebody to love. And so this loving God became a creating God, and in six short days, he made everything that was made, including on the sixth and final day when he made you and me in the persons of Adam and Eve. But then, in what felt like no time at all, God's perfect creation got totally messed up, right? Because first Eve, then Adam, then Cain, and so on, until literally every single person on the planet thought they knew better than God, so they started doing all kind of stupid stuff that left them utterly broken. But our loving God went to incredible lengths not only to cover their shame, but to give them his perfect rescue by, get this, he gave them a fresh new start in a brand new place with more kids and way better grandkids, plus this amazing promise of a far greater rescue yet to come. A rescue God first predicted here, with a greater rescue ultimately presented in section 2 of God's great story. So some time passes. Earth's population increases. Man's wickedness also grows, as every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. And God was grieved and his heart filled with pain. Why? Because God loved the people he had made, and he only wanted what was best for them. However, every person on the planet still thought they knew better than God and kept on doing stuff that left them broken. So once again, God comes to the rescue, this time through Noah, a man who was faithful long before he got fickle, who built God's rescue in the shape of a wooden boat, so that God actually rescued humanity by nearly destroying humanity. But that would be the last time, because God promised Noah, and he sealed it with a rainbow, that never again would he use a wooden-shaped boat as his rescue. But instead, in his perfect time, this far greater rescue was yet to come. What I want you to see is the Bible really is just one epic tale with a grand and sweeping theme that's all about God's greater rescue yet to come. Now, there are other threads in this story. Take Abraham. He's the next, or I of God. God chose Abraham and his descendants, beginning with Isaiah, or Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and then the 12 tribes. And every single person in that thread, they thought they knew better than God. So they wound up doing stuff that left them broken. And that's why the Egyptian slavery, where for 400 years Israel was held captive. But hang on now, because God would go to great lengths to rescue Israel, this time by sending Moses. Remember him? Moses was sent to help bust the people out of Egypt, give them a fresh start in a new place called Canaan. And though Moses lovingly warned them, saying, if you fully obey the Lord and carefully follow all his commands, the Lord will set you high above all the nations on earth. However, if you don't obey, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Now, Moses was a great story in his own, a storyteller in his own right. And so he not only listed in Deuteronomy all of these curses and blessings, he gave them an object lesson so they would never, ever forget that they needed to follow the commands of God. Get this. Moses put 6 of the 12 tribes up on Mount Gerizim and the other 6 on Mount Ebal, and the crowd on Gerizim would shout out the blessings for obeying God, and then the crowd on Ebal would shout back the curses, kind of like a huge pep rally. We got spirit. Yes, we do. We got spirit. Problem is, they knew the cheer, but they also knew they knew better. Even though Moses also thought he knew better, and though he did get to see the promised land, he didn't get to go in. Although the people did get to go in, but they lost on their way in their greatest leader ever. So God again goes to great lengths to rescue them and find another leader, this time a young kid by the name of Joshua, who led the people so well, they get another fresh start in a whole new place, a place that was beyond awesome because this place was their place. Yet, if you can believe it, they still thought they knew better and they started following foreign gods. I mean, come on. God gives them the promised land, a place of their own, and yet not only do they start embracing lesser gods, they do a whole bunch of other bad stuff too and wound up broken. So God once again goes to incredible lengths to give them another merciful rescue, this time in the form of judges. But don't think old men in black robes. These judges were one part military hero, another part political statesman, plus a MacGyver kind of like problem solver, all rolled into one. And yet the stubborn people of Israel still thought they knew better and would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods. So God would raise up another judge. And that's the whole book, just one cycle after another of the people pridefully doing stuff that left them broken, till God had compassion on them and he would rescue them, along with this promise from the new judge of a greater rescue yet to come. Over time, the people even got tired of this routine. That's one reason why they came to God and begged him for a king instead. But even then, with awesome kings like David and Solomon, the people still thought they knew better, and they wound up doing more stupid stuff, even though it always left them broken. So broken this time, they get hauled off into captivity. But even then, God goes to great lengths to rescue them, this time through the prophets. And you want to talk about going the distance. God's prophets had a real flair for the dramatic. For example, Isaiah, he walked around naked, true, for 3 years in public, just to embarrass Israel into following Israel's God instead of Egypt's God. Ezekiel shaved his head for that same purpose. And Jeremiah went to a pottery shop and made some really bad pottery, whereas Elijah called down fire from heaven. All really cool stories in their own right, but just minor threads in the macro story of God's divine rescue. Now, Isaiah is universally regarded as the prince of the prophets, and he put it so well. This guy got so frustrated because these people always thought they knew better. Listen to what he said. I reared children and brought them up, but what did they do? They rebelled against me. And he went on to say, the ox knows his master, the donkey his owner's manger, but Israel does not know. In other words, you people are dumber than donkeys. And that's why for the next 400 years, nothing. Almost like all the way back at the beginning. Nothing from heaven at all. No light, no teaching, no prophet, no judge, nothing. I hope you're seeing it. The Bible is not this collection of random stories, each with its own unique takeaway and a few added rules here and there regarding what you got to do to make God happy. No, it's one grand story of the one and only God who made us, only to watch us, because we thought we knew better, do stuff he knew was going to leave us broken. But stay tuned now, because 400 years later, here comes God again, moving heaven and earth again to make all things new for all the people he loves. Are you with me? God's story, it's not about all this stuff you got to do to be good people. It's the story of what God has already done to bring you back to himself. And that's the whole story. This epic saga of warriors and rebels and poets and kings, they're all just bit players in this rising arc, this upward trajectory, the escalating drama that is the ultimate rescue of God, a drama that is found in every chapter on every page in this story. Except the story isn't complete yet. The dots aren't yet connected. Remember how I said that in the Old Testament, with every great rescue God made, he predicted an even greater rescue? A rescue he finally presents in the New Testament? Well, we are here now. So let's see for ourselves this greater rescue God kept pointing to. Because once upon a time, in his perfect time, God sent his son. Meanwhile, the whole world is still thinking that we know better than God does. And so we're still doing stupid stuff, stuff that leaves us lying in a ditch, utterly broken. But God, as he had always done, is still going to great lengths, and he makes a far more substantial stretch than he'd ever made before by leaving the glories of heaven so that he could give all people for all time a far greater rescue. And since you and I, in fact, since all people throughout all the ages, since we were all on his mind on that first Good Friday afternoon, when Jesus went the ultimate distance to give us his once-for-all rescue, that's when God wrote us all into his story of rescue, signed, sealed, and forever delivered that first Easter morning when, you know the story, once and for all time, the stone was rolled away. The tomb was found empty, and those two angels asked the women the same question that we've got to wrestle with. Why do you seek the living among the dead? He's not here. He has risen. Now, most of us already know that part of the Easter story, right? Which is why I want to show you the other part, the lesser known part, because the story of God's rescue, it still needs to find its ending. And who better to tell it than the master storyteller himself? That same day, still Easter, two of Jesus' disciples were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Now understand, they hadn't gone to the tomb. These two are still reeling from the travesty of losing their leader. Now, we know that Jesus is raised. They don't. All they know is the gore of Golgotha, this ugly scene that meant more than just losing a friend. This was the death of their dream. Everything they'd lived for and bet their futures upon, what they just knew was going to be the grand story of their lives, that story, it's now his story. Turn out the lights. This party's over. And so they're walking those 7 miles back home, still reeling from and talking with each other about everything that had happened. And because it was 7 miles, folks, and if Wiki is right, the average person walks 3.1 miles per hour, even if they walked briskly, which isn't likely since they're grieving, this walk would take roughly the equivalent of a full-length feature film, meaning they got time. And so as they discussed these things, what things? Well, the crucifixion, his hasty burial, but mostly, what do we do now? Were these last 3 years for nothing? And see, that's why their faces, Luke says, were so downcast. Have you ever been downcast? This is more than sadness. This isn't just droopy-tailed or long face. This is downright misery. You're down in the mouth, weighed down, downhearted, down in the dumps, but mostly downcast. Understand, just days before, these same two were unbelievably up. Remember Palm Sunday? Upbeat, uplifted, up and coming, up and Adam, Adam and... Oh, sorry. Now, in the very next verse, we're told that one of the two was named Cleopas, or Clopas, another variation of the same name. In case you're wondering about the unnamed one, over in John, we're told that one of the women who stood near Jesus at the cross was Mary, the wife of Clopas. Now, some very careful Bible students, and I happen to agree, actually believe it was Cleopas and his wife on the road that day. So we got Cleopas and Mary wrestling even as they're walking and wondering. In fact, the word Luke uses suggests maybe they'd even been fussing about it, kind of disputing everything that had happened, which makes sense because if John was right and he did in fact record everybody at the cross that day, what if Mary showed up but her hubby didn't? Maybe that's why there's tension. And so they're discussing all these things when Jesus happens by. They don't know it's him, and starts walking with them, although they were kept from recognizing him. So to them, this is a stranger. But what I want you to understand is these two disciples were broken. So broken, Jesus makes this extraordinary effort to come along beside them. They don't know it's him, but he's about to give them his perfect rescue. Now, I just want to pause and go, wow. Because here it is, folks. We're 4,000 years from the garden, but the same story. Now, what Luke doesn't tell us is how long it took Jesus to catch up to them, or whether they were so intent on their marital discussion that they didn't even realize he was there. All we know is this stranger just shows up and wants to know, what you guys talking about? They look at him like, well, where have you been, under a rock? They're shocked that anybody could be so out of touch as this stranger seemed to be. Dude, what else would we be talking about? Of course, we're talking about Jesus of Nazareth, you know, the prophet from God who was powerful in word and deed, except the chief priests handed him over and crucified him. We had hoped he was the one who would redeem Israel. Please don't read that too fast, because that's the same story all over again. We had hoped. It wasn't in the cards, but we'd hoped. Have you ever hoped like that? I mean, live long enough, friend, and you will, and those three words will be written across the headline of your life. I'd hoped we'd raise a strong family and I'd have a good, long, healthy life, but the doctor called. Or I'd hoped I'd have an incredible, world-changing kind of career, but I lost my job. My life feels void of purpose. And I was hoping that I could have kicked this stupid habit, but instead, I'm such a loser. We were hoping that our son, he'd have his act together by now, but we just got a call and he's in custody and every dream we've ever had for him, it's just broken. That's how most people talk hope. I didn't know. I wasn't sure, but I sure did hope things would work out somehow, some way. Problem is, that kind of hoping really isn't hope. If anything, it's just kind of wishing upon a star, a namby-pamby, godly, gee-willikers, Batman, kind of squishy, slushy, I want it to happen, but it probably won't happen kind of whine. And not at all the kind of hope the Bible says can anchor your soul. You see, true hope is a confident assurance that, yes, God is able, plus an abiding certainty that nothing is going to come my way that God and I together cannot handle. But that's not these two. For them, the story of Israel was one long, unbroken chain of misery. And because they had hoped for a different story and a way better ending, maybe we ought to hang with Jesus. I mean, he's a prophet. He's powerful in word and in deed. He says stuff nobody else has ever said. He's doing stuff nobody else has ever done. And so they decide that he's the one they're going to hitch a ride upon. And he's going to set God's story straight again. And they conclude, incorrectly, that he's going to lead a revolution and conquer Israel's oppressor, and Israel would be like she had been under King David and Solomon, prosperous and mighty again. And they pinned their whole lives on that hope because they just knew their ending was a way better ending than God's. And so they did. They concocted a dream about the coming Messiah that never was God's dream, and became convinced that God was going to set Israel free by kicking some Roman fanny, military style, leaving Pilate out, Jesus in. But instead, Pilate is still large and in charge, and Jesus is dead and in a tomb. But because they thought they knew better than God, they wound up heading away from where Jesus was and embraced something far lesser that ultimately left them broken. Where have we heard that before? Donald Miller once wrote that everyone experiences what he calls a story arc. What he means is we all start our life story pretty much the same way. I'm going to change the world. Get married and make babies, not necessarily in that order. Plus, buy a Beamer, a house or two, and oh yeah, totally outgates Bill Gates. And in the early chapters of our lives, some of those lofty expectations actually get realized with an opening win here and a burst of impact there. Some folks' stories start out so incredibly awe-inspiring, we actually start thinking, you know, life really is a piece of cake. I'm doing way better than even I thought I would do. But then we come to the middle of our story. And that's when, although some of my goals were reached, I'm still not happy. And in fact, I'm working harder than I've ever worked before, and there's not nearly as much to show for it. And even if some parts of my story did turn out relatively okay, I've still got this nagging sense that something that really matters is missing. And because, well, it's because something is missing. What's missing is the end of your story. But the end of your story is something only God can write. That's these two. They're stuck in the murky middle of their story. A story that began when they started following this amazing person named Jesus. But now they're in the middle of the story. And what they thought would be a better plan than actually God's plan, it just wasn't working out anymore. And because they didn't have enough hope to see beyond the murky middle and how their story would, in fact, ultimately end, here's what they did. They grabbed the ball and went home. My world is crashing. This wasn't the plan. Mary, we're going home. And that's when this stranger goes out of his way to give them rescue. How does he do that? He begins with this line, "How foolish you are and how slow." Well, that's kind of rude. I mean, here they are pouring their hearts out. A stranger comes along and insults them. That's not an insult. It's what was happening. Have you ever experienced a time in your life when you thought you understood your story, but you found out in a moment of blinding clarity, you had no clue at all? A married couple had no secrets except for one shoebox that the husband kept and told his wife she was to never open. But it got the best of her, so she looked. and felt so guilty about it that as soon as he got home, she just kind of blurted it out. "I'm so sorry, babe, but I looked in the shoebox. Please forgive me, but, you know, all I found, 3 golf balls and about $18,000. I mean, what's the big deal? I don't really get it." He said, "Well, okay, here's the thing. Every golf ball represents the number of times I've been unfaithful." Yeah, tough blow. But she finally said, "Well, I guess after 40 years, that's not too bad. 3 times, I can forgive that. But where'd all the money come from?" He said, "From selling golf balls." I love that story. Because that's the human condition, right? You think you know your story, but you don't. And one day you'll find out that your story really is this, but you don't know that right now. You think you do, but it's like waking up from a deep dream. It's an altogether different story. Or maybe you're walking down a road you never thought you'd be on, but here you are. The beginning of your story, not so bad. The middle of your story, and the problem is, you got no clue how this murky middle is going to lead you to the ending you always thought you were going to have. That's this stranger. You guys don't get it. And it's killing you because you can't see that the greatest rescue ever would require what it required of me. I mean the Christ. How foolish you are. How slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ. Now hang on. That's Jesus' title, folks, not his last name. Jesus was the Messiah. He was the Christ, the chosen one, the anointed of God. Which is precisely the problem for those who try to tell Messiah's story. Because what happened then and still happens today is we pick through the parts we like and ignore the parts we don't like, even though what we end up tossing is what God had planned for us all along. But then when things don't turn out the way we planned, we get miffed and we get depressed. Primarily because, and it certainly was the case for these two, they got so pumped up on pure emotion and not on the clear expectations the prophets had taught them to embrace. So as far as they're concerned, the death of Jesus was the end of hope. Yet this stranger wants them to realize Jesus' death was actually the birth of hope. He asks, "Did not the Christ have to suffer these things?" And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them what was said in the scriptures concerning himself. You know, I've heard some decent preaching in my life, but can you imagine listening to the author of the Bible teach the Bible with special emphasis on the parts he wrote about himself? Wouldn't you have loved to have heard that? I mean, here's Jesus telling the same story I just told, but way better. Although our stories have this in common, there's just one and only one central theme, a theme that's all about people thinking they know better than God, and so we wind up doing stuff that leaves us utterly broken. But God, in the person of Jesus, our Messiah, gives us what he taught us all along to look for. A greater rescue through Christ alone. Don't get me wrong, this couple knew all the right stuff. They knew all that the prophets had spoken. They did, but they missed the point, primarily because they were hoping for something that wasn't even close to what God had planned. They thought the story was about the Messiah freeing Israel, something Jesus did do. He just did it in a far bigger way than their hopes could even conceive. You see, what Jesus did was he let Israel remain politically and temporarily oppressed under Rome rather than allow the whole world to remain forever lost in their sin. And so instead of doing battle with Pilate, Jesus fought the one battle he knew we could never win. And in so doing, he rescued the whole world, including Israel. And aren't you glad he did? Don't judge these two. We do exactly what they do, what they did. When God doesn't do it exactly the way we want him to do it, it's really hard, isn't it? We come to him with our preconceived notions and our ill-conceived dreams, and invariably we walk away disappointed, because my felt need is rarely my deepest need. And what seems urgent isn't nearly as important as I imagine. Kind of like the fellow who went to a pet store. He bought a singing parakeet. Wanted a companion, so why not a bird that can sing? And sure enough, he came home the next day and was greeted to this beautiful, uplifting bird song. And he was thrilled and went over to the cage to say hello to the bird. And that's when he noticed, my parakeet only has one leg. So he called the pet store and he complained, "You sold me a one-legged bird." The owner said, "Sir, what do you want, a bird that can sing or a bird that can dance?" Not a bad question. What exactly am I hoping for from my life? What is it that I think that I need? What do I truly need? That's Jesus' question. What do you people want? Temporary freedom or eternal life? Because I came to give you life. And that's why Jesus took the time to teach them what was said, I love this, in all the scriptures concerning himself, because he wanted them to know what you and I need to know when we're confused by the twisting in our story, that God is always in control, no matter what. And what better way to communicate that than digging it out line after line and precept upon precept, just carefully reviewing the written story of God's faithful dealings with his creation throughout all the ages. You do that, and I'm telling you, this is what you're going to find. It ain't over till God says it's over. So if you're stuck right now in the middle of your story and you're wishing upon a star that you could just find a decent end to your story, please know this. It ain't over till God says it's over. And that's why the angels asked such a piercing question earlier that same day. And it's just as applicable in your life right now. Why? Why do you keep seeking living things among dead things? Don't you remember how he told you all about all of this? None of this stuff is accident. None beyond his control. He told you. And now he's telling them again. Corrie Ten Boom, a survivor of the Holocaust, once said, "When the train goes through a tunnel and everything gets dark, you don't throw away the ticket and jump off. You sit still and trust the engineer to see you through." And that's why Jesus took the time to tell the story, because his story, folks, it's the story. And he is our one and only engineer. And even before this world had a beginning, he was there. This wonderful, loving God who loves his people so much that even when we do think we know so much that we know better than God, so we wind up doing really stupid, sinful stuff that leaves us shock, utterly broken, without any hope for rescue at all, all we got to do is go back to God's story and read it again and again and maybe again. And here's what you'll find. You're not the first person to ever cry. You're not the first one so deeply discouraged, discouraged enough to just want to jump off the train. You're not. Go back. Go read God's story again. Because his story, thanks to Easter, has finally found its perfect ending. Because not only will God give you, he's promised he would give it to you. He will give you his perfect rescue. In fact, the truth of the gospel is he already has, finally and forever. So this stranger tells this confused couple, given everything I've taught you, what if the depth of Jesus' suffering actually confirms his identity instead of disproving it, as so much of the world would like to think? And what if the crucifixion in Rome isn't Rome's defeat of Jesus, but rather it's God's defeat of our brokenness by crucifying forever my sin, my guilt, my shame, forever? What if throughout all of human history, the whole story of absolutely everything were squeezed down to just one man crawling through the opening of what had been his own tomb? But now it's the light at the end of a long story we've all been longing to find. Can you see him? Do you see him? It's Jesus. Can you believe it? He just squeezed through his own tomb's tiny opening, and there he is, dramatically and victoriously standing on the other side. No wonder their hearts were burning as he told this story. Speaking of the story, it was nearly evening, the day almost over. Jesus is done talking. The three are still walking till they come to the end of the road. And they ask the stranger, would you like some dinner? And when he sat down at the table with them, he took the bread, he gave thanks, and he broke it. And I don't know, but the storyteller in me would like to think that when Jesus broke the bread, Cleo and Mary saw the fresh wounds of a crucified Savior. And they got it. That's when they realized that every chapter in the story of their lives was true. The one who said he would come to rescue them from their brokenness had in fact come. And though he himself also had to be broken, when they saw it and they made the connection in the story, that's when their eyes were opened and they recognized Jesus and goosebumps start racing all over their body. And that's also when Jesus disappeared from their sight and they looked at each other and said, "Were not our hearts burning within us as he revealed to us the end to our story?" And then they got up. Look at this. And returned at once to Jerusalem. How far away was Jerusalem? 7 miles. What time was it? Trick question. The day was almost over. The third and final day of a very long weekend, including the crucifixion of their leader, no sleep the night before or after he died, plus a 7-mile hike, yet they leap up and they hoof it 7 long miles back to Jerusalem, all in one utterly awesome day. And do you know why? Because they finally knew the end of their story. That's why. And they just had to tell somebody. And that's where we will leave them. Can I be brutally honest with you, just as brutal as this stranger was? Unless I miss my guess, there are a lot of people in this room who had a fairly decent beginning to your story. But I'm guessing there are also people in this room who are in the middle of your story, except it's just not working anymore. Not saying you're a total disaster, just saying, like me, you're kind of broken. Something is missing. And that's why when the RV is parked and your finger isn't flipping through Facebook, when you're not binge watching something on TV and life is kind of quiet and another day almost over, when it's just you and your story, something doesn't feel right. And maybe you feel downright broken. Now, don't get excited. I'm not going to ask you to admit that right here in front of God and everybody. But what if you weren't surrounded by people right now? Especially people who would really like you to say that. If you're at all like me, if they didn't want you to say it so bad, you probably would have said it by now. I need God's rescue. But see, what that means is you're letting your flimsy little ego keep you from the rescue that sent God racing down from the atmospheric reaches of heaven itself to bring to you the end of his story, which he wrote just for you. The perfect end to a story, let's be honest, that has been less than stellar. If I could, I would write God's ending for you. I would. Because I know that God's story can ignite a fire in your heart and give you a hope that will never die, the kind of hope that could absolutely change everything about your story as it now is. If I could do that, I would do that, but I can't. Only you can. But I can beg you, please step into God's story. The story of you as written by God. Come on, stop seeking living things among dead things. And instead, embrace God's preferred ending for the story of you. Because here's how it would read. The heavy lifting, my friend, is already done. And it's been done since the day that Jesus squeezed through that tiny opening and what had been blocking him from finding his way to wherever you are. And all that is left for you to do is just let him. The end. Let's pray. So we're going to share in the meal of Jesus. And if you're a follower, we invite you. However you want, just take the bread and the cup and remember him, because that's what he asked us to do. Even if you heard the conclusion of this message and you've decided, man, I want to embrace God's story of me, I invite you to this meal. That's a great first step in. But then, would you tell us about it? Maybe stop by the new here table. I'll be glad to give you a call and sit down, because I want to help you get started right. But Jesus, I just want to thank you. This story of Easter, it is so immeasurably more than we think it is. It really is all about the way my story can end. Father, I don't know every story in this room, but I believe with everything that is in me that you can make every story in here right. And I know it's true because of Calvary, and then 3 days later when you, Jesus, sneaked through that tiny opening and stepped out alive, never, ever to die again. And one day, Lord, maybe it's not today, but one day, and I hope it's not too late, every tongue in this room and every knee in this room, the tongues will speak, the knees will bow and claim Jesus as Lord over all. God, I'm just asking that that happen now rather than then. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray together.